What time did you say? What time does it say now?
5:09. Okay. Well, that's fast. Eva Smith.
That was the previous owner of the house.
Oh, Eva.
Yeah, she lived for a long, long time there.
Oh.
And Evelyn sort of idolizes her. She learned about her and stuff.
She's
like
a school
that.
Teacher also?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be.
Oh.
But she lived there. She never married, right?
Mm-hmm.
She was an artist?
What? She lived in the house Evelyn lived in. Okay.
No, she wasn't an artist. She was just a person, but I don't think she was a wonderful person.
Oh, okay.
The Magician Ramana. Three stanzas from Rudanar. Suttarutau. Translated by Professor K. Swaminathan. Have you read that one? The Suttarutau. That's the name of the work. Three stanzas from Ruganar's Suttarutau. Awareness wherein brightly shine these many forms of persons, places, time, all separate seeming, though in substance one. And to that same awareness he transmuted this eye of mine. Now nothing to be known, my past undone, my being his, I stand unruffled bliss, untouched by any shock. Lord Shiva Venkatesha, he who, king of kings, came conquering, and made me his alone. Second stanza. What is this I that rises from within? Only a thought that, like a bubble, floats up to the troubled surface of awareness. In sleep, the sea is still. No bubble rises. Then too you are. You're not the eye that rises and then sets. You are the sole awareness and the all, the eternal, uncreated light of being. Third stanza. No form or feature has he of his own. Yet form and feature to all beings gives. Knowledge and ignorance, both to him unknown. Each human mind from him alone derives. He brought me into being, but to think of him as you, of me, and mine as yours. And he has left me wordless, deedless, prone, helpless on death's brink. Only the vast beatitude endures. Companionship with Bhagavan by Vishwanathan.
By who? Vishwanath?
Kavya Kanta Ganapati Muni, the well-known early disciple of Bhagavan Ramana, familiarly known as Nayana, once lived for 4 months in a small tiled room facing the Ganapati temple of Palakkattu. That was the only building there when Bhagavan came down, that Ganapati temple. And they came down to that, besides graveyards around.
It's still there.
Yeah, that Hilda, you know, she sort of sponsored that.
Oh, okay.
She used to sponsor all these bhajans there, made a library next to it and everything.
Okay.
She's no more than a German lady. She lived in Paul Brunton's house.
And
that house was given over to the person who used to attend on her. Who used
Hilda
to help
MacIver?
Her? Paul Brunton's house in Palo Koto.
Hilda MacIver?
No. Hilda, I may forget her last. Some German lady.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
She lived there for 30 years or so.
She was here, right?
No.
No?
No.
But her daughter lives in California.
Oh, okay. There was some Hilda that...
Well, yeah, Hilda Kapoor. Hilda. Oh, okay. This is Hilga. Oh,
okay.
So, for 4 months, in a small tiled room facing the Ganapati temple of Palakoto, in the year 1929, I had the rare privilege of sharing his room and serving him, immersed in the spiritual aura of that great tapasven and yogi. He was a very simple man, with few physical wants, so it was a pleasure to serve him. You know, I have a bunch of manuscripts written by Viswanath Swami of Ganapati Munis. You know, verses. He used to write them out by cantation. It involved no physical or mental strain at all to live with him. Having a natural inner poise, he was always relaxed, despite his brilliance and quick wit. Everyone felt the warmth of his friendliness and the air of purity and peace about him. It was no wonder, therefore, that Bhagavan Ramana, despite his equal vision, had some special regard and love for him. This expressed itself in many ways. During these early years, Bhagavan used to go alone, without an attendant, for his short afternoon stroll past Palakoto, and often dropped in to sit for a few minutes with Nayana. It was neither what Bhagavan did nor what he said that mattered. It was his glorious presence that shone above all. Yet the familiarity with which he moved with his intimate devotees was heartwarming. Bhagavan was opposed to any sort of waste or extravagance. Quote, "How do you light the fire of your charcoal stove?" he asked me one day. I told him that I used a bit of old rag rolled up and dipped it in kerosene. Smilingly, he scolded me for wasting kerosene when the fire could easily be lit with some of the dried twigs and leaves lying around, or with bits of waste paper. On another occasion, what if he only knew that what was coming about waste?
No.
On another occasion, he saw some small bits of paper, about 1 inch by 6, lying on the floor of Nayana's room, and asked him if they were of any use to him. Nayana replied that they were waste pieces that he had cut off in cutting some sheets of paper to the required size. Bhagavan said, "I can stitch these pieces together and make a little notebook the size of a thumb, and use it for writing something or other in." Nayana beamed with pleasure at this economy, but I, to save Bhagavan the trouble, offered to do it myself and to make use of the paper. Perceiving my motive, Bhagavan said, "All right, but you are to show me the stitched notebook and the use you make of it." On my undertaking to do so, Bhagavan dropped the matter, as he had confidence in my sincerity. As soon as Bhagavan had left, I made a tiny notebook out of the bits of paper and wrote down in it the 100 slokas of Indra Sahasranama Stotra and its 7 concluding verses composed by Ganapati Muni in 1929. Footnote: the 1,000 names of Indra, called from the Rig Veda. Nayana composed his litany of these, adding no other words. Indra refers here, of course, to the Supreme Being, not to the Indra of the Puranas, who rises to a godly state by merit and again falls from it. Bhagavan appreciated the deep spiritual significance of these names, and they were read out to him during the composition of the work and even before. So next morning, when I showed Bhagavan the tiny notebook with the Indra Sahasra Nama written in it, in small script, he scrutinized as is his way, footnote. Agamaa was extremely observant. Even on receiving a letter, he would examine the envelope with address, postmark, and stamps before opening it. Not only the contents, but the stitching and general appearance as well, and then exclaimed with pleasure, "You have kept your promise and made the best use of the bits of paper. I somehow lost the precious notebook handled and perused by Bhagavan. I need not say how glad I shall be if this lost treasure is found and restored for the benefit of all." Someone stole it. Why else would he even say it like that?
Exactly.
He doesn't want to say someone took it from him. From his room. Or he probably lent it to somebody and they never returned it. You know how the books... The present ashram building had not yet been erected, and Bhagavan was living in a thatched hut adjoining the mother's shrine, or samadhi shrine. Nayana used to sit in the presence of Bhagavan for about 2 hours daily, before and after sunset. This is a part of the day known as Pradosha in Sanskrit, and traditionally held sacred to the worship of Shiva. But for Bhagavan and Nayana, there was no special time of worship, since they were perpetually flaming with tapas transcending time and space. One evening, Nayana asked Bhagavan about the forests, which at that time still existed on and around Arunachala, saying that he had been in forests in other parts of India, but not here. Bhagavan, full of benevolence, at once offered to take him to the forest on a fine day, and said with a radiant, almost boyish smile, "Nayana, there is no inch of ground all over Arunachala that has not been trodden by these feet during the time when I was living on the hill, especially during the Virupaksha period. I have been up the hill and down the dales, and roamed about the interior regions where no forest guard would dare to go." One cloudy day, a few days later, I went to Bhagavan after lunch as usual. He was sitting alone. As soon as he saw me, he asked what Nayana was doing and whether he would suit him to go for a walk in the forest. I replied that Nayana was writing something, but would jump with joy and gladly drop it if he heard of Bhagavan's proposal. "Go and tell him, then, and be ready," Bhagavan said. "I will slip out of the ashram unobserved to avoid a crowd and meet you near your room." Probably said he's just going for the call of nature or something. I'll be right back. Bhagavan joined us a few minutes later, and the three of us wandered our way towards the forest, led of course by Bhagavan, the born leader, through uncharted regions, physical as well as spiritual. We entered the second forest path, cutting through the cattle fair ground, west of Palokoto. You know those grounds, right? Usha, the cattle fair grounds?
Yeah.
I don't know if they're still using it or they built buildings on it now. I think there was this big area.
Yes.
It was on the north side of the Giri Production Road, you know. I've seen the cattle fair. They kept doing it for many decades. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful little temple of Draupadi, with an arresting atmosphere about it. Thence Bhagavan took us to the third forest path, skirting the slopes of Arunachala at varying heights. He said there are three Giri Pradakshina routes. You know, the one which is the road, then the inner one, then the one close skirting the mountain. Who knows what they were? No, no. It was dense forest with creepers entwining the trees and bushes. There were a few streams, some of them flowing and some dried up. As we proceeded along the windy, rugged path, enjoying the beauty of the scenery and the ever-changing aspects of changeless Arunachala, the clouds cleared away and let the sunlight in for a few minutes. Knowing that Nayana could not stand the heat of the sun on his head, Bhagavan took us to a spreading tree standing at the edge of a forest pond and said, "See, Nayana, this is the tree known as Engudi, famous for its cooling shade and medicinal properties, described in Sankuntala and other famous Sanskrit works. It is called Nilali in Tamil on account of its very cool shade, which wards off the effects of the hot sun in no time. And 5 minutes under the shade of the tree proved it to be so." As soon as the clouds gathered over again, giving shade, Bhagavan took us deeper into the forest. Later, he found a very pleasant place for us to rest on the bed of a dried up stream, shaded by a huge rock to the west. We did not speak much. One does not feel like disturbing the eloquent silence of Bhagavan in harmony with nature by indiscreet talk or even thought. He teaches in silence. Time passed unnoticed and the gripping presence of the Lord of Silence until Nayana suggested that it was getting rather late for Bhagavan's return to the ashram. Bhagavan said that we would wait for the afternoon breeze, which would soon start up and make walking pleasant. A few minutes later, the breeze indeed start. At the same time, we heard the sound of someone moving through the bushes to the south, and looking that way, I saw Muruganar's head above the bushes and announced his presence with surprise. Bhagavan, who was a marvelous actor, placed his finger along the side of his nose, as was his habit when surprised, and expressed his surprise that Muruganar could have penetrated so deep into the forest and discovered us. Muruganar had by this time caught sight of us and heard our voices, and a few minutes later he joined us and prostrated full length before Bhagavan, his face flushed with emotion. Bhagavan asked him, however, he had managed to find us out in this unfrequented spot where even the forest guard would find it hard to do so. Muruganar explained in a voice choked with emotion that he was present when Nayana expressed his wish to see the forest and Bhagavan proposed a walk there, and he decided not to miss the opportunity of accompanying us and Bhagavan deep into the heart of Arunachala. So since that day he had been daily coming to the ashram as early as possible in the afternoon from the temple of Arunachala where he was staying. That afternoon, he had not found Bhagavan seated on his couch as usual when he came. The people in the ashram had no knowledge of his whereabouts. Wasting no more time, he went straight to Nayana's room at Palokottu and found it locked. He inquired of the watchman, who told him that earlier in the afternoon, Nayana and I had been seen walking with Bhagavan in the direction of the cattle fairground. Some intuition made him choose the path he did, which brought him straight to Bhagavan. We all three returned with Bhagavan to the ashram, unaware of anything but Bhagavan's grace, the only reality shining through all forms and movements, and playing hide and seek with us all. This is a filler by Dr. C.T. Ramaswamy Iyer, Vice Chancellor of Annamalai University. The Maharshi was asked by someone whether the belief in the necessity of a guru is correct. He gave the following reply. So long as one thinks of himself as little, laghu, he must take hold of the great, guru. He must not, however, look upon the guru as a person. The sage is none other than the real self of the disciple. When that self is realized, then there is neither guru nor disciple. The question arose because the sage himself had no guru, at least no other guru. On another occasion, the sage said, a teacher would be needed if one had to learn something new. But this is a case of unlearning. The Maharshi in Healing by Dr. T. N. Krishnaswamy. Some aspirants have asked, what was the Maharshi's attitude to spiritual healing, and why he did not actively encourage it? In this article, Dr. T. N. Krishnaswamy delves into the difficult question. Some people hold that spiritual healing should be practiced as a part of sadhana. Spiritual healing is a process by which power from a higher level is invoked to descend and help at the lower human level. The higher is not reluctant to respond to the lower, but many difficulties stand in the way of the lower coming in touch with the higher. Prayer should be from the highest state of consciousness possible to us. Christ said, when thou prayest, enter into thine inner chamber, and having shut the door, pray to thy Father, which is in secret. And this Father, which seeth in secret, shall reward thee openly. But if a man can purify himself utterly of self-will, he becomes one with the Father, that is a jiva mukta. Then his very presence is the greatest good and greatest balm to all human suffering. Miraculous cures may result from the outflow of healing grace from him. If a sick man makes himself a recipient of this grace by his faith, he gets cured. But the cure is natural and spontaneous, and not the result of any purpose or intention on the part of the master. But what of healing by one who has not attained this supreme level? Can he influence God as an advocate influences a judge? If God is spirit or consciousness, no one can influence it or make it do anything for anyone. What is it that heals, and how is one to influence it? Bhagavan did not encourage pondering over such problems. They are of no help for spiritual progress. One should concern oneself with the self alone. Whether the body is sick or well, there is the same I. One should experience the I, which is in everyone and is the same in everyone. This does not mean that Bhagavan was indifferent to the sufferings of those around him. He was supremely compassionate. Once a lady devotee brought the news of the death of her only daughter, and hearing it, Bhagavan wept along with her. The Buddha advocated contemplation of suffering and its causes as the way to escape from it. Suffering is the prime problem of existence. But the earthbound mind cannot comprehend the spiritual. To draw conclusions about God from what we see on earth is entirely wrong. The earthbound mind may think of the external world as a theater for divine vengeance and wonder what can be done to pacify the anger of God. But God neither punishes nor rewards and cannot be influenced. It is the very nature of the mind to create mysteries and be baffled by them. Bhagavan warns us against seeking a remedy in the outside world. There is no peace to be gained in it. Our concern is with the spirit, which is within. The body being made up of matter cannot suffer, neither can suffering touch the self, which is spirit. What is there between the two which suffers? This question takes us in search of something within us which is eternally young, beyond time, and ever free, but which is at present obscured. One should set aside some time daily in which to be separate from oneself and the outside world and abide in God. Quote, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, You shall ask what you will, and it shall be done unto you. Unquote. The panacea for all the ills of the world is to stop being an individual and be one with God. Bhagavan said that the primary disease, the root of all other diseases, is ignorance of the self. When asked to cure his own body, at the end he said, the body itself is a disease. The root symptoms of disease are body consciousness and world consciousness. One should try to heal this main disease rather than the lesser diseases from which the body suffers. The cause of suffering is ignorance of the real nature of the world and the inevitable evil of coming in contact with it. One is advised to shun the world by diving into oneself. The relation between body consciousness and world consciousness produces suffering. We use the body to keep up contact with the world, unaware of the painful consequences of such contact. One should not be encouraged to seek the small solaces of this world as if they were the things of God. All experiences, birth and death, health and sickness, good and evil, are equally manifestations of one mind and are on the same level of reality or unreality as the mind. The world, the sorrows thereof, the compassion which seeks to relieve such sorrows, are all dream experiences of a sleeping mind. When there is awakening, everything vanishes, including the person who felt compassion in the dream. One should use the manifestations of God to guide one to their source. To study them in themselves is only to increase one's perplexities and to get involved in them. Once a devotee who had strong faith in the Maharshi brought the corpse of her only child right into the hall where he was sitting.
Jesus.
He asked what it was. She said, my dead son, and I pray and beseech you to grant him life. The Maharshi sat silent for a while, as was his custom, and then gently said, please remove the body to a nearby cottage and let us see what happened in the morning. She had the dream that some Mahatma came and restored life to the body, and she thought the Mahatma was Bhagavan, so she brought it from Andhra Pradesh by train, had to pay a lot of money to bring the corpse. And she thought Bhagavan was a person. And Bhagavan said, if your dream is true, your boy will be restored in the morning.
I'll come alive. Nothing after they left.
The Maharshi sat for a while. Then he said, please remove the body to a nearby cottage and let's see what happens in the morning. Nothing happened, and the boy lay dead. But something happened to the minds of the relatives, and they removed the corpse and cremated it, realizing that they should not expect the dead to rise. The Maharshi later remarked that even an incarnate God cannot raise all the dead. He has no individual will, so he cannot decide to perform such and such a miracle. If miracles happen in his ambience, he witnesses them. That is all. God radiates his grace throughout the universe, irrespective of whether beneficiaries are there to receive it or not, like the sun and its light. God's grace cannot be stopped. Bhagavan said that the very existence of a jiva mukta is the greatest blessing to the world. Spiritual practice aims at helping human awareness to realize its identity with universal awareness. Identification with the body, whether healthy or diseased, is a result of misuse of the mind. Subject to this misuse, a man seeks a comfortable body and a comfortable life. If we are concerned with maintaining and using this body to keep in touch with the world, we are thereby perpetuating suffering. The compassion of the Enlightened One goes beyond pity for the ills of the body, is heir to and has rather pity For the false identification with the body which makes these ills inevitable. A jaundiced eye sees everything yellow. The split mind sees God's hand where it is not. The amount of pain and poverty in the world has made men doubt if there is a God at all. The omnipresence of God cannot coexist with the miseries and ills that surround us. God's will is not being done in the world. Man's will has kept God out. So one should not search for God in the world, but inwardly. Where the ego is present, no good or God can be present. Where the ego is absent, no evil or one can be present. The body that is emptied of ego becomes the shrine of God and manifests its omnipresence and omnipotence. Such was the divine state in which Bhagavan lived and moved among us. He proved this possibility, that a man can be one with God. Outturned mind is bound to see the world and its sorrows. The inturned mind is still. This stillness is the spirit. The purpose of this article is not to argue for or against spiritual healing, but only to show both possibilities, both viewpoints. Jesus healed the sick and said, "Thy faith hath made thee whole." This showed that two things were necessary and had to conjoin: the grace flowing through the master and faith on the part of the recipient. In the Maharshi's life, healing played little part. Footnote, though certain cases of healing will be recorded in our next issue, editor. The world is as it is because men have desired such a world, not because God created it this way. The Maharshi's teaching is totally directed towards leading us out of such a world to the source of the I by intensely raising the question, who am I? How he came to see me, by Gurudev Malik.
Gurudev Malik.
Yes, it was he who came to me out of his abounding grace. I had not then even heard his name, let alone anything about his abidance in the being of, and wisdom of the Eternal. It happened this way. Nearly 35 years ago, I volunteered to work for a short time under the officiating editor of the Theosophists of Adyar Madras. On one occasion, he gave me a few books to review for it, and among them a small booklet entitled, Who Am I? As I read this, I became more and more absorbed in what I had what it had to say about self-inquiry as a means to realization. After I put it aside, a feeling of deep peace and bliss enfolded me like the arms of a mother, and I remained in this state for quite some time. When I finally came out of this exalted state, I seemed to see with my inward eye a radiant face with starry gaze, and I bowed spontaneously before it in heartfelt reverence. After this experience, I resolved to use inquiry every day. I continued to do so for many months. This enhanced my eagerness to touch the feet of the mighty Guru. But alas, I never found an occasion while he was among us in bodily form. When at last an opportunity to visit the ashram did come, in April 1950, the visible had already entered the invisible. Some years later, by God's grace, I went on a pilgrimage to the shrine of this Great One. Once again, the radiant face which had shone on me some three decades before gladdened my inward eye, and I felt blessed to the very depths of my being. Also, by the Guru's benediction, a glimpse of the Self that is at the heart of life was vouchsafed to me. My salutations of love and reverence to the Self of the Guru and the Guru of the Self. Here's a poem by C.S. Bagi. To Sri Bhagavan, the One Eternal Reality. The world is still. The light and sound and thought, and light and sound and thought, transfixed in space and time, like insects caught in amber rock, are bygone things unwrought, in cosmic consciousness where all is not. Alas, how vain are eyes that think they see, and ears they hear, and mind that it is free. True freedom is to stay all thought and be, like waveless waters of deepest sea. No more can I be still than go astray, for fixed is all I do from day to day. My steps upon the round of time must stay. Without thy grace I cannot even pray. But what is fixed to me to thee is void. Through hardest rock thy softest will can ride. All fire, all water, earth and air must hide. Like me, this mock existence, thee beside. Recollections of Bhagavan by Major Chetan. He had a great sense of humor, and when talking, a smile was seldom far from his face. He had a great fund of stories, personal and from the scriptures, and was a magnificent actor. He would always dramatize the protagonist of any story he was telling. It was a sight, for instance, to see him depicting fear, he who never knew fear. When the story was very pathetic, his voice would be choked with tears so that he was unable to proceed. When people came to him with their family stories, he would laugh with the happy and sometimes shed tears with the bereaved. In this way, he seemed to reciprocate the emotions of others. He never raised his voice, and if he did occasionally seem angry, there was no ripple on the surface of his peace. Talk to him a moment later, and he would answer calmly and quite undisturbed. For the rest of us, some effect of anger will remain for a while, even after the cause has gone. Internally, we take time to regain our peace. He would never touch money. This was not because he hated it. He knew that it was necessary for the purpose of daily life, but he just was not interested in it. Money and presents came to the ashram management. That was all right. They needed funds to maintain the institution, but he was indifferent to it. People said he would not talk, but this was a foolish legend spun out of his saying that his real teaching was in silence. Sometimes he would talk freely. Often also he would sit silent. In every way, he liked simplicity. He preferred to sit on the floor, but was induced to use a couch. He would never, if he could help it, allow preference to be shown to him. For instance, in the dining hall, he was adamant on this point. Even if some tonic was brought for him, he would refuse it unless it was supplied to all. "If it is good for me, then it must be good for them too," he would say.